web services.
All right. So welcome to the Cloud or Not podcast. We are your hosts, Michael and
Andreas Wittig.
We have been building on AWS since 2009, and here you can follow along as we develop products like BucketDB, AttachmentDB, Marbot, as well as HyperEnv, and you can learn from our practice. This is episode number 93, and we are recording this on April the 10th in 2025. And in case you're watching this live on YouTube or LinkedIn, feel free to ask questions in the chat, and we will have a look at them either directly or at the end of the show. So, Andreas, I'm going to start with the first topic, which is about, we discovered a problem during our migration from Amazon Linux 2 to Amazon Linux 2023. And this was mostly driven by our product BucketDB, which is an antivirus or malware solution for Amazon S3, and it is running on EC2. So we had the need to switch to Amazon Linux 2023, and we were running into a couple of things. And this was actually one that I discovered quite late. And it is about, I would call them low memory instances, like the T3 Nano, T3 Micro, so instances with less than 1 gigabyte of memory. And there are a couple of issues with those instances that I encountered. First, there was, and it was actually fixed this week, an OpenSSL performance bug in Amazon Linux 2023, which they fixed this week, which makes things like calculating a checksum incredibly slow on low-performance instances like the T3 Nano. And for our use case, what we do basically is we download files from S3, and then we calculate the checksum to make sure that this is the correct, like we downloaded the whole file and everything is correct when we update the virus signatures database for the Sophos engine. So we calculate a checksum and we compare it, and if it matches, we are happy, and otherwise we just kind of throw an error. But it turned out that our software running on a T3 Nano was so slow because of that, because calculating the checksum actually was taking like seconds for very small files with a couple of megabytes. And this is actually caused by this problem. And it should be fixed now. And I hadn't had the time to verify this before the show, but I just received an email yesterday from GitHub that the issue is closed, and it should work now better. So this was the first thing we were running into. I mean, the issue basically was there for all instance types, but you notice them on instances with low performance, because otherwise it just takes a little bit longer, but you don't notice it. Okay, the second issue that we were running into is that the temp folder is backed by memory in Amazon Linux 2023, which is okay, but if you don't have memory available, it gets a problem. Because, and this is this next problem that we talk about, what actually happens if the system is out of memory? And there was also a change in Amazon Linux 2023. So the first change is that temp moved to memory. In systems with low memory, that is a problem. And it gets even worse because of the next point I'm going to talk about. The question is, okay, how can you turn it off? How can you move temp back to the disk? And there's actually a unit that you can disable, or as to use the system language to mask, and then you stop the unit, and this will ensure that temp is no longer backed by tempfs, which is using memory, and then it's just stored on disk. So you mask the temp.mount unit and you stop the temp.mount unit, and then it is back to disk. And the next and the most important piece that changed in Amazon Linux 2023, and this actually didn't change from the beginning. So they introduced this change while Amazon Linux 2023 was already released. And I have all the links available so we can put them in the show notes. They moved to ZRAM, which basically means that if you're running out of memory, what happens is that the Linux, I think it's the Linux kernel or something inside the Linux kernel, will start to compress the memory. And this is, again, using a lot of CPU cycles. But if you're running on a T3 Nano, you don't have many CPU cycles available. And so things get just incredibly slow because Amazon Linux 2023 takes almost all the memory that is available for itself. So you have 512 megabytes of memory available to the system, and mostly all of it is consumed by the operating system. So whenever your application does anything, it has no space to store it in memory, so this SATRAM thing will start to compress memory, and then if you access it, it will uncompress it, and then it needs CPU cycles, and things get just incredibly slow. So what we did, which was also what we did before, is, okay, we removed the SATRAM stuff. You can just uninstall it, like DNF remove SATRAM generator and generator defaults. This is the name of the packages. And then we add again a swap file. And this is basically just a file that is, it lives on an EBS volume, and you can turn it on as a swap location. So if you're running out of memory, it will just store it on a file on EBS, which is also very slow, I must say. But it is not as slow as using the SATRAM approach. So we switched back to that, and then things were back to normal. I mean, if you run on a T3 Nano, you don't have very high performance expectations, I would say. So it's okay if sometimes you reach out to a swap file on EBS instead of crashing the system and have the out of memory killer just randomly killing processes. So it is working much better than the SATRAM approach. And this was the only kind of way for us to get T3 Nanos back working with our software. So that's kind of what I found. So OpenSSL performance bug temp folder is kind of backed by memory, and SATRAM, which is basically compressed swap to memory, disabled to disable it, and then things get back to working with T3 Nano. So I don't know if anyone is actually able to use current T3 Nano with Amazon Linux 2023. I cannot imagine it that it works the way it is today.
Yeah, and that's quite interesting, Michael, because I think, so shouldn't the Amazon Linux be optimized to run on EC2 instances, and especially also the small ones? So it should, if you change things like that, maybe you have to, I don't know, modify it based on the instance type.
So SATRAM is only enabled on instances with less than 1 gigabyte, as far as I remember. But the funny thing
but
is
that's
that,
even worse. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it only affects the small instances. And I think they were kind of surprised by this as well. Because if you read the changelog of Amazon Linux 2023, they say that they enabled SATRAM because tools like DNF, which is kind of the YUM replacement, sometimes they kind of download all the information, the repository metadata, basically, and do the refresh of their index. And this was not working on a T3 Nano because it takes 800 megabytes of memory, and there's only 512 megabytes available to the whole system, right? And so they introduced the SATRAM kind of, I think you can call it a fix, because they missed it. And it was just not usable at all on T3 Nanos. And then they probably quickly needed a fix for it, and so they jumped on the SATRAM wagon. But it
seems they didn't test that as well, because that's...
I mean, if you have a lot of time, you can run DNF update and then just wait 5 minutes and it works. But I mean, if you run it on an M5 large, it takes a couple of seconds. So I don't know if it's working or not. I mean, it is very slow.
Okay. That's interesting. That's really interesting. Also, I'm wondering why they're shying away from having the swap file on disk. Is that because they don't want to have it on EBS volumes by default?
I mean, what we do is we bake it into the AMI, which makes the API, and we have an 8 gigabyte swap file, which is quite large. I mean, we could probably have it a little bit smaller, but it basically increases the size of your AMI if you pre-allocate it, and otherwise it will eat into your disk space. Yeah, I mean, you can trade disk space for swap file, basically, and I think they don't want to do that, so they use the memory compression. And I think things get very, very interesting if you turn off unlimited mode on the T3 nanos, because by default they can just, I mean, if they run out of cycles, the 10% cycles, they just buy credits. And the problem for us was that this is not guaranteed to work, right? So if you are on a busy host, you don't get extra capacity or extra compute capacity. And so it gets so slow. It's really, it's crazy.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting finding, Michael. So I'm always kind of amazed how much can go wrong running something.
Yeah, I was also
on
amazed
an EC2 machine. So it seems to be very easy, but then there's a lot of detail.
The good thing, Andreas, is that we actually didn't notice that before we released the product as well. So we just discovered that because a customer discovered it. And we now have a test that also runs our test suite on a T3 Nano. So we are now safe to kind of ensure that our system works on the smallest instance type that we support.
Probably Amazon Linux 23 is better tested by us than by Amazon.
Yeah, maybe they add the same test as well. So starting with a T3 Nano and see if it works. Yeah, that would be a good test. So
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Michael. Very good. Yeah, very interesting findings. Thanks for sharing them. The next topic I want to discuss is our journey of getting ISO 27001 certified. So let me start at the beginning. So for about, I think, 5 years or a little bit more, we have been selling software mostly on the AWS marketplace. But our main product, Bucket AV, is a software solution that the customer runs in their AWS account. So that means the data processing happens on their cloud infrastructure, the customer's cloud infrastructure. So this is a model that we like very much, and our customers like a lot, because they do not have to hand over their sensitive data to a third party like us. It works well for everyone, I would say. But then last year, we started working on what we call attachment AV, which is basically bringing antivirus malware scanning to other cloud platforms like Atlassian for Jira, Confluence, to Salesforce. We also provide an API and WordPress and so on. But with that, we are basically moving into new territory, which is we are providing software as a service offerings. So now the applications that do the scanning send the data from the customer to our backend system, where we then run the Sophos engine and to scan the file. So now we process customer data on our backend system. And this led to the thing that many of potential customers, many prospects, they wrote in and asked us, basically asking the question, how can we trust you that you are protecting the information, the data that we send over to your systems? And of course, that's a very legit question, especially as a company that is not well known everywhere. So, we thought we saw this coming up as a question in our sales discussions more and more. And many customers have been asking us about whether we have a certification. And there are a bunch of them out there, but many of them ask about an ISO 27001 certification. That's why we started basically looking into that. First of all, we had doubts, I would say, Michael. So we were not sure if this is the right thing to do for us. So we are a two-person company, right? So we thought, is it for small companies like us? Is there even a chance to get ISO 27001 certified, right? So this was the first question. Do we have enough people to fill all the roles that are needed? Stuff like that was a question. Even is it worth the effort, the overhead, the management, and all the effort that goes into that? Is that worth the effort? So we were not sure about that. And then the other doubt, Michael, we had is we expected that the process of getting certified is probably a lot of boring paperwork, not adding too much real value to everything. So this was, I would say, our assumption when we started looking into that. But it turned out differently. And I think I want to share a little bit about how we made that happen and how we got. So that's the spoiler. We got certified. So we are now ISO 27001 certified. But I want to share little details on how that worked. So first of all, what is ISO 27001 about? So the certification is about that you as a company basically set up an information security management system. And the information security management system is basically there to fulfill a few requirements. So one is, the first one is you need to identify and assess the risks, the information security risks. So what are the risks that our company faces on an information security level? So this is basically what you need to track somewhere. So give you one example, you need to track all the vendors that you work with. So we are working with Amazon Web Services, we work with Google Workspace, and so on. So you need to have a list of all the vendors that you work with to make sure that you have basically everything inside that is relevant to information security. Then you need to somehow measure and handle risks. So you need to make sure that you detect risks in about information security, and you take countermeasures to basically reduce the risk. And you need to do that by implementing processes that regularly review and update those controls. So that's basically on a very high level the summary of what you do. And you basically have software. That's the information security management system. You have a software that helps you track all the assets, track all the risks and the measurements and the controls that you have in place. And that is basically what ISO 27001 is all about. And then we looked into how do you get ISO 27001 certified? And I would say there are two main ways to do it. So the first one is you hire a consultancy that helps you implement all the procedures, all the processes, and introduces an information security management system. Or there are also tools out there that you can basically buy software as a service solutions that automate the whole process and guide you through the process with very little human interaction. It's basically just a software solution that guides you through all of that. And this sounded to be a good option for us because we're a very small company. We don't have any fancy thing. Everything runs on AWS. We have Google Workspace and GitHub. That's more or less the most important production relevant systems. And so we looked into a software solution that helps us to set up this information security management system, have all the policies and procedures in place. And there are a few providers out there. We, at the end, chose Sprinto, which is one of them. They describe themselves as a continuous security and compliance platform. And I think the idea behind that is they try to automate most of the things that you need to cover with your information security management system. And that's quite interesting. So how does the whole process works? In our case, Sprinto, so you can use other tools as well, but this is just one example. Sprinto integrates with many infrastructure or information security relevant systems. Let me say it like that. So there's integrations for Amazon Web Services, for Google Workspace, for GitHub, and many more. And basically the first step that you do is you connect all those integrations, which then starts to collect data basically from your from your infrastructure, from your cloud infrastructure. And this is one important aspect. And the other aspect is, depending on the compliance framework that you choose, Sprinto creates you the documents that you need, which is the procedures and the controls, and the policies and procedures that you have in place. So basically, here is written out what is required for the level of information security that we want to achieve. So things like, I don't know, we have a process in place to make sure we are deleting access to systems when an employee or contractor leaves the company. That's one example. This is written down, and it's written down who is responsible for that process, who needs to make sure that this is in place and working. And there are many other examples of that. Let me give you another one. There's another one that says data has to be stored on disk in an encrypted way. So that's another thing that you have to follow along. So now the idea of Sprinto and other tools like that is they basically automatically validate that this is the case. So they go, in our case, through our Amazon Web Services accounts, scan all the resources in there, and then check out the results. So you can think about it a little bit as security hub controls, which do similar things, to be honest. But the checks here are basically coming from the ISO security, the ISO 27001 controls, and then are implemented as automated checks, which is very cool. And same for GitHub and other systems. So for our example, it took us about 8 weeks to basically configure all those integrations and to implement all the requirements that came up during the process. Okay. So I want to highlight one thing, which is, I think, especially interesting for this podcast and for the audience, which is how in this case, Sprinto handles the infrastructure on AWS. So the cool thing is the AWS API allows you to describe all the resources in your account, and you first get, it's very easy to get a list of all the assets that belong to your AWS accounts. And the first thing you do is then you classify them as this is a production asset or this is a non-production asset. Because the checks, basically, they only apply to production assets. And in our case, we have separated production and non-production workloads in different AWS accounts. So for us, it was very easy to basically add the accounts that run production workloads to Sprinto and run the checks for all those resources in the account, with a few manual exceptions, because you always have a few resources in an account that are not production relevant that we then marked manually as non-production. And then with Sprinto, we run into an issue, because at the beginning, when we started a project, there was no way to automate the rollout of Sprinto to multiple AWS accounts, which was a bummer. But luckily, they implemented the feature in the time span that we implemented or gone through the project, and then it was possible to use AWS organizations and CloudFormation stack sets to roll it out to all accounts that are relevant. So this was cool. And then, as you know from Security Hub, if you run a tool with automated checks, you get a lot of findings. And what I learned here as well is it's not worth to implement or to fix every finding that comes up, because there are always, I would say, some false positives. So it's not always advisable to just implement what comes up. I'll give you one example. So one of the checks that Sprinto implements is they check for every DynamoDB table whether you have enabled backup functionality of DynamoDB to be able to restore to a certain point in time. And we have a bunch of DynamoDB tables where we don't enable backup. But that's for a reason, because we use DynamoDB tables a lot to store things like sessions or short-lived markers that we then delete after a few minutes automatically with a time to live attribute. So it doesn't make much sense to backup those tables. And even worse, if you would enable backup for those tables, the cost would go up because you have a lot of data coming as that you write and delete immediately afterwards. So that all goes into the backup and adds up to the backup. So yeah, so I think that's important if you then follow the findings that you always double check if it really makes sense and adds any value to implement the change that is requested. Because if not, you can also mark it as an exception and basically argue and document why you're not following the standard here. Yeah. Okay. So one more thing. So I think the thing where we gained the most from the whole process. And at the beginning, I said we were a little afraid that the whole thing is only producing a lot of paperwork and doesn't add real value. But what really added a lot of value to our information security is basically the vulnerability management. So we have used GitHub's Dependerbot and AWS Inspector in the past, and we also keep all the dependencies in our projects up to date. But we didn't have a process defined for that. So we have been doing it from time to time. We made sure that we have installed the latest patches and so when releasing a new version, but we didn't really track vulnerabilities. And now, because we are going through the process and prepared for the certification, we had to establish a process that makes sure we are fixing vulnerabilities right away. So this is what we now have in our information security management system. And I think that's really cool because if either Dependerbot detects a vulnerability in the dependencies that we have in our software projects, or if Inspector detects a vulnerability on one of the systems that we run in production, basically that shows up in our sprint or dashboard. And then there are rules applied, really hard rules, I would say, for at least for a two-person company. For example, critical vulnerabilities need to be fixed in 3 days. High vulnerabilities need to be resolved in 30 days. So that is for us something we have now to keep an eye on, and we get notified about it and fix it within those time spans. And I think that's really a huge benefit that we got from going through that process of getting certified. Yeah, so I think overall, preparing for the ISO 27001 certification, it helped us to establish processes, and it really improved, I would say, our information security standards in our company and helped us a lot. We learned a lot. And also, I think the next thing is we hope that this helps us to build trust with prospects and customers for Attachment AV. Yeah, so I'm quite happy with the results. And I didn't expect to basically learn and improve something. And it was very, happily surprised about that.
Yeah. That's a great story, Andreas. And I must admit that I would never started getting ISO 27001 certified.
Yeah.
It was just like, this is the benefits of having like a co-founder basically on the team. So that's great. I'm very happy to see that it worked so well. And I have to share one funny story, Andreas, or at least I think it's funny. So more than 15 years ago, when I went to university, I had a course on, I don't know how it was named, but it was basically about ISO 27001 and also, I think, 9001. Mm-hmm. How's it called? A standard? I don't know how it's called. And this mm-hmm. was the guy talking about the topics was, his background was, he was running a security company, but not an IT security company. So he was running I don't know how to call it, like a real security company. Like when there's an event, they have security people around and making sure that everything is working fine, checking people at the entry and things like that. So this was his background. And I mean, so there was no sprint tool, right? And so he did everything with paperwork, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so boring. And that might also kind of influence my I don't know, my dislike of these kinds of things. But yeah, this was really, I think this was the worst mark that I had or got during university, was about the ESO certification stuff. So yeah, this was really funny. But yeah, so last topic, Andreas, right? So we are running through the next topic.
Yes.
And this is actually more like a report of a newer AWS feature. In step functions, you now can use, besides JSON path, you can also use what's called JSON NATA or JSON NATA. I don't know how to pronounce it properly. Which is basically, I think in my own simple words, it's a much better approach to write your state machines than using the old JSON path approach. So it's more flexible, and it is, I think it provides a better experience to developers. One most notable change, besides a couple of others, is that there's no more, like, with JSON path, when you had an attribute that you want to kind of make dynamic, you always add it at the end dot dollar sign, and then in the value of the property name, you kind of specified the JSON path. So this is gone. There's no more dot dollar sign. So if you're just writing state machines, you know dot dollar. So you can just, it's not existing anymore. The names of the properties are different. So you're not using the same property names. They are all called a little bit differently, which makes it a little bit hard to kind of, at the beginning, to understand, okay, is this now a JSON path example? Is it a JSON NATA example? So I think it will take some time for the internet to kind of catch up and all kind of the results on Google moving to JSON NATA. And even, I mean, maybe ChatGPT kind of examples will be JSON NATA sometime as well, if the internet catched up. But yeah, this is a really cool. And basically what you can do in any attribute, you can have a JSON NATA expression, which starts with curly braces and the percentage sign. And then you can write an expression. And expression also can contain functions. So you can have functions that, like string functions like split. You have array functions like merge, or like set or object functions like merge. You can combine multiple objects into one, which is very handy if you have JSON kind of data, and you have maybe there's an input coming in, but you also want to merge something else on top of it, or you want to provide default values, then you have your defaults, and then you merge the input on top of it, or something like that. So merge is really one that I use a lot. There's also some Boolean operators to check if properties exist or not, and this was really more or less a pain or not possible with the JSON path approach. So if properties did not exist, it just throw failure, so this is now possible, and all kinds of things. And what I also like is that I'm kind of old school guy, right? I use Sieve and Lint to kind of validate my templates after they are generated, even if I generate them with CDK. And they also catched up now recently. And this was, I think, last week or the week before. Now they have full support for JSON data, like all the properties and so are supported. So you can use the tooling as well now. I mean, it took them a couple of months to catch up. But now everything, all our Sieve and Lint checks are green again. No exceptions anymore. And this is just, I think it's really worth, if you are using step functions, if you write your own state machines, it's really worth the time to get used to the new approach. It will take you a couple of maybe hours or days to kind of adjust your approaches and your used ways of working with step functions. But then you will be I think you will be quicker, and you produce more readable and more understandable state machines.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, Michael, I've been using the new format as well when writing a state machine, and really enjoyed it. Yeah, very much improves how to work with defining the step functions. Cool. Thanks for sharing, Michael. So yeah, this was episode number 93 after a 6-month pause. So we hope to be back sooner than that with the next episode. Thanks a lot for listening and watching. Don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter, the podcast, or the YouTube channel, so to make sure you're not missing the upcoming shows. And if you have feedback, send it to hello@cloudonaut.io or find us on LinkedIn and Mastodon. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye.